Welcome, everybody, to the Sandoff Fighting Arts Podcast. Today, we are with our guest, Jeff Pratt, who is a Tai Chi instructor and practitioner at Yonge's Martial Arts Association of Boston. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, Ty. It's very nice to be here. I'm happy to talk with you.
Awesome. So, Jeff, just to kind of get started and to kind of get people to meet you and get an idea of your experience in the martial arts, what kind of martial arts and what kind of involvement in martial arts do you have?
Okay, well, I've been practicing Tai Chi Chuan from the style that's associated with Yonge's Martial Arts Association, as opposed to, say, Yonge family style, for more than half my life. I started when I was 21 at YMAA in Boston, and I've been practicing ever since. I'm 53 now, so this, you could actually call this old guy martial arts in one sense. You know, I don't think my history is anything unusual for somebody who practices a martial art for any kind of a long-term period. You know, I found a teacher in a school that I really liked, fortunately, for me. I've just been really lucky to be associated with a good group of people over the course of that time. And I've always had a lot of fun and new challenges and things to learn, so I've stayed with it. My principal interest, I guess, is in two-person Tai Chi, pushing hands.
Okay.
That's what I've always really found most suited my personality, and I had some degree of natural ability with it, so it's what's worked out for me. Excuse me. You know, not that I'm, compared to some of the other people that I've known over the years, particularly a natural talent. I just happen to be a pretty big guy, so that makes pushing hands a little bit easier for me. And the aspects of Tai Chi Chuan as a martial art really, I've discovered over time, suit my personality, as opposed to some of the other styles that I've tried. I did judo for a while when I was younger, not for just a cursory examination of it, a few months, less than a year.
Okay.
And it didn't work for me. And when I first started at YMAA, I did Shaolin White Crane and Long Fist for 2 years, maybe.
Okay.
Just because YMAA offers Tai Chi Chuan, Shaolin, Long Fist, and White Crane. And I was at the school all the time for Tai Chi anyway. And I had a lot of friends in the Shaolin group, so they said, you should come over and try the Shaolin. And I did. And the mindset of a hard style, which the Shaolin styles were,
yep,
as opposed to the mindset of Tai Chi Chuan, which is a softer internal style, didn't really work for me. So I stopped practicing that just because I'm really very firmly of the opinion if you're not having fun doing it, you shouldn't. And I won't throw my full effort into it. You know, I mean, martial art on one level, particularly in today's world, is almost a luxury.
Yeah.
So why, you know, if you're not enjoying it, you know, if you don't want to go in and do the things you need to do to get better, why bother with it? You know, that's find the thing you like to do and go do that, and it'll be a much better experience for you.
Yeah. Sure. So
go ahead, please.
You had checked out some other sort of styles of martial arts before landing on Tai Chi, but so how did you first even hear about Tai Chi? I mean, why was that something that you ended up being drawn to? Like, where did you find, or was it just you happened to walk into that school and that's what they offered?
Well, it's a little bit convoluted, I think, like anybody's life can be. My best friend at the time and still to this day is a gentleman named Jim O'Leary, and he was going to college over at BU, and he somehow or another stumbled upon YMAA at that point in time, and he started doing it, and it really suited him on any number of levels. And socially, I got to know a lot of the people at the school because we would all, you know, I was a friend of his, and so sure. I would wind up at parties that people at the school were throwing and things like that, and vice versa.
Okay.
So I got to know a lot of the committed people at the school, the guys who had already been there, you know, several years. And about 2 years into making friends with people at the school, you know, every time I would see them, they would be, oh, you got to come and try class. And they would suggest Tai Chi because, you know, they saw me socially and they said, it really seems to suit your personality. I actually didn't have any real idea of what it was, but everybody else seemed to be having a good time with it. So I said, you know, let me go in and try it out. So I think Tai Chi, at least initially, was something that I got into because of peer pressure, you know, as opposed to any of the other bad things you could do with your life because of peer pressure.
Sure.
I stumbled into martial arts, you know.
Yeah. Pressured into a Tai Chi class is probably a better route than some other things.
Absolutely. Of all the things you can wind up doing, you know, because your peer group is telling you you should. And it really, the decision to join YMAA really is, and to study Tai Chi Chuan even beyond that, is the best, you know, because I said initially, and I'm 53, so occasionally you look back at your life at this point in time, I think.
Sure.
It's the best single decision I ever made because literally every good thing in my adult life, other than things that I got because of my family, you know, I was fortunate to have a great family and still to a certain extent, have a good family, in the family that I got from birth.
Sure.
You know, those are the things, you know, but you don't have any choice with that. You don't.
Right. You're kind of brought into just, what you got. You dealt the cards you're dealt.
Absolutely. You know, but the friends you acquire and the experiences you seek out, those are your choices. And the choice to study with Dr. Yang Zhuangming and the YMAA organization and the friends that I made because of that, and really led to, as I say, every good thing in my life. They directly led to my wife and daughter. I met my wife in a Tai Chi class that I was teaching.
Oh, you know, wonderful.
You know, she's made me a better man. And Tai Chi Chuan was the start of that process. You know, I think any discipline that one can pursue that has, you know, rules and a goal that one can aspire to, whether it's, you know, playing a musical instrument or pursuing something in the performing arts, or even something as wonderful as, say, woodworking or something like that, where you can...
Yeah, kind of any art.
Yeah, it gives you an avenue. It gives you a set of tools to explore yourself as much as anything else.
Yeah, and for me, I would agree. I feel very similarly in terms of what sort of any art can kind of bring you, depending on the depth that you're going into or sort of how you connect to it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's still wonderful to this day how that still happens in my regular practice. I'm fortunate that I get the opportunity to teach, and because of that, the questions that I get from my students and the wonderful ways that I can plan for what I can do in class, and somebody will ask a question and it'll totally derail what I want, what I was expecting to do, and force me to think about things in new ways and try to sometimes on the spot come up with
right
drills that will approach the questions that they ask, make it a wonderful thing, both in how I get to deepen my understanding of the art, and how so occasionally I will get out of class and I'll realize I just improvised the last hour and 10 minutes of what I did. And that's pretty, and sometimes I think it's hilarious, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And occasionally I felt like telling the students that, but then I think, no, I actually want them to think I know what I'm doing when I'm doing this stuff. So, and I'm not riffing, you know?
Yeah, of course. Well, so for folks listening, of course, I also am an instructor at the same school, Young's Martial Arts Association of Boston, both for Tai Chi and for the Shaolin, as well as Zanda. But for folks, I think most people, when they hear Tai Chi, they think of sort of the health practice of Tai Chi, or what we call Qigong, kind of the energetic side, as a health practice. They don't always associate it with the sort of the martial side, which is something that you had touched base on a little bit in terms of push hands. Can you talk a little bit about sort of your view and your sort of understanding of Tai Chi Chuan as a martial art, and kind of where it's coming from in that aspect?
Certainly. I think it's a style that can be, now let me preface that by saying that I don't want to pretend to be some kind of action hero or anything like that.
Sure.
You know,
which of course you are, but you don't have to start with that.
I've been lucky, in very lucky in my life, to sometimes deliberately and sometimes I'm sure by luck have avoided violence in my life, you know. And there are, and you know, obviously in this world today there are any number of people who will, you know, unfortunately be the victim of violence and things yep. like that. And, you know, so I've always had the mindset that, for better or for worse, if you at least think about and try to prepare for that kind of thing happening, you're that much closer to surviving it in a livable condition. And to get back to your direct question, what Tai Chi Chuan is, strictly speaking, Tai Chi Chuan is a soft style in that the emphasis is on relaxing the body as much as possible in order to facilitate the flow of qi within the system, which is where a lot of people, which concerns a lot of people for its health aspects. Now, qi is considered the living energy in the body, and it doesn't have an analog in Western society. But within the discussion of Tai Chi Chuan, you learn to soften, to relax your body so that you can move qi around more effectively and energize your muscles to a higher level of capability, which in a combat situation, at least in theory, will allow you to strike with greater force and to react with greater speed. Now, how tactically Tai Chi Chuan wants to do that is, Tai Chi Chuan is a defensive style. It does not want to initiate an attack. It wants the other individual to initiate so that it can in turn connect with the incoming attack and deflect or lead the energy of that incoming attack away from the Tai Chi Chuan practitioner, and then build counterattacks off of that. And that skill set is called neutralizing. So, you know, you can design specific movements in Tai Chi Chuan to deal with punches or kicks. And at least our style of Tai Chi Chuan is based in a traditional Chinese martial art. So it incorporates striking, which is punching and kicking, hitting with any part of the body, seizing and subduing techniques, which would be chinna, the idea of joint locking or submission holds.
Yeah.
And then takedowns for, and to a lesser extent, although I don't have much knowledge about this, ground fighting. That's a traditional martial style. But on a broad philosophical level, you know, you'll hear almost any Tai Chi practitioner, a Tai Chi Chuan practitioner who knows anything about the style, they'll say, we're going to use soft to defeat the hard. So we're going to use our soft, relaxed movements to defeat the hard, aggressive movements of the opponent. But the trick is being able to do that, you know, to work your training in such a fashion that you can embrace the principles, some of which are counterintuitive.
Yep.
And, you know, and that's where, as they say, the rubber meets the road. That's the hard part in Tai Chi Chuan, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in any style, there's the theory and there's the application.
Absolutely.
And plenty of styles have, you know, theory that, you know, is broad and spans a lot of different sort of areas. And there's styles that have a lot of sort of direct application. And of course, when it comes right down to it, it's kind of what you can do opposed to just what you theoretically are talking about doing. But I think overall, it's interesting. Not everybody even understands that Tai Chi has some of that theory, that it actually has something rooted in traditional martial arts.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I was really shocked because in some ways I've only ever studied at YMAA for Tai Chi Chuan, that sort of thing. It's really where I've spent the majority of time. I've worked with other teachers and seminars and things like that, but I've never, I found a place I like, so I didn't go looking around for another spot.
Right. You find something that fits for you. There's not as much reason to seek other.
Yeah. And I know other people who have followed other ways and they're wonderful martial artists. So you got to figure out which one works for you, but that's what I wound up doing. And I had an experience about 10 years into my training where there used to be an event that was held regularly on upstate New York. It was called the Chan San Feng Festival. And it was held and it was a celebration of the creation of Chen style Tai Chi, Chan San Feng being the legendary creator of the style. Chen stylists might be mad at me for saying legendary, but you know, there's as much legend as there is in fact in the stories you hear about Chan San Feng.
Sure.
But the event was held in about an hour outside of New York City on a farm, you know, called the Tai Chi Farm. And it was run by an instructor, a wonderful, wonderful gentleman named Joe Sung Hua.
Yeah, who, Master Joe.
Master Joe, yeah, I say this with the point of view, before I talk about the moment of the event, Joe Sung Hua was he was a character, he was a wonderful man, and he seemed to get younger every year that I would see him. And, you know, when you talk about any of the Chinese martial styles, you almost inevitably run into the concept of enlightenment and spiritual growth. And really, out of everybody that I have ever met who in this sort of slice of humanity that practices martial arts, Joe Sung Hua, in my opinion, he got it right. He really was, in my opinion, enlightened, because he was simultaneously playful and serious, and he embraced these concepts really wholeheartedly. And that's sort of a departure, but you know, I was always very impressed by him, not only as a practitioner, but as an individual, you know.
Sort of a good representation of what can kind of be accomplished and come out of embracing the arts.
Yeah, because literally he would seem to get younger every year. And I went there for I think almost 10 years once I started going, before his unfortunate passing. And you know, but anyway, the first year I went there, and I went with a bunch of people from YMAA, and Dr. Yang was invited to teach Chinna and Tai Chi at the farm. And there were several hundred practitioners there. And it was really shocking to me and to the other individuals in our group at the time, how few of them could even conceive of Tai Chi Chuan as a martial art, that it could be used for self-defense or for combat, whichever term you want to use. You know?
And these are Tai Chi practitioners?
Yeah, absolutely. These are people who at that point in time had been practicing Tai Chi for quite a long period of time, years up to decades, you know, and some of them had never even been exposed to the concept, you know, and never mind any kind of a practical experience with two-person Tai Chi. And that's why I think Dr. Yang has a great quote in one of his books. He starts out a chapter with it, I think. He says, learning Tai Chi Chuan without pushing hands is like buying a car and not driving it. You know, I love that quote because it really gets at the essence of how one understands Tai Chi. It's something that I encourage the students that are in my form classes. I tell them, you know, even if you're not worried about self-defense or, the deeper levels of the art, which are sort of inextricably intertwined with self-defense. I said, to really understand Tai Chi Chuan, you have to do some pushing hands. You know, you need to do a little bit, particularly as I've grown to appreciate it. Like when you read the Tai Chi classics, the collected bodies of poetries that are the foundation of the art.
Yep.
When you read those, you realize they're not talking about doing your form. They're talking about, you know, combat and how one deals with an opponent effectively using Tai Chi Chuan. And it's crouched. And admittedly, I don't read Chinese, so I rely on the translations, but it's crouched in these poetic terms. So I think that's some of what that has thrown Western practitioners off, is that the source documents, unless you put out the effort to learn, you know, period Chinese so you can read them, you have to rely on the translations. And unless you get your hands on a good translation, you could be very easily led astray, because it's easy to look at them and apply everything to solo practice.
Sure.
But it's only after doing a bunch of pushing hands over the years that I realized that they're actually talking about working with a partner. And when you think that at its core, Tai Chi Chuan can be described as balancing yin and yang, the defensive and offensive, or feminine and masculine forces in the universe, the polar opposites that drive the universe.
Yep.
You need input from another person in order to learn those balances. You know, if you cannot bring your capabilities up to dealing with another individual's aggressive energy, then you don't really understand what Tai Chi Chuan is going for, because that's to me at least very clearly what it's going for.
Right. It gives you a little bit more feedback on your training that you don't just get on your own, or you can't quite get when you're working. Whereas I think there's plenty of benefit from either. It's something that I feel like I've kind of taken on this idea at martial arts at large. You see a lot of sort of extremes, even like on Tai Chi, where there's a lot of just solo practice, people that aren't interested in push hands, but again, they're not maybe getting the depth of what that art has to offer, even if they're not interested in the martial aspects.
Yeah.
And on kind of the far other side of the spectrum, there's a lot of combat sport and there's a lot of fighting arts that are so focused on technique and partner work that there's a lot within the martial world that, you know, they're kind of missing out on because they don't have that balance. And a lot of times you even see, you know, I know plenty of people that started in a very external style or a combat sport that kind of made their way to Tai Chi, even if it's just as a supplementary training to kind of balance things. And it also to speak a little on sort of the documents that we that you touched base on, and a lot of the stuff I feel like that we practice, because you know I've also been doing Tai Chi for a long time. I originally started in well when I was a child, I started doing karate. I started in Kenpo karate. And then when I was in my tweens, I kind of switched and started doing Kung Fu. And then from there, pretty soon after, I started doing Tai Chi. And originally when I started, I did not like Tai Chi. I didn't really see Tai Chi as a martial art. And it was, you know, sort of slow moving is kind of the stereotypical what people think of when they say Tai Chi. And at 13 years old, I had a really hard time slowing down and appreciating it. Now I'm very glad that my teacher sort of had the foresight to introduce it to me early. And, you know, I had always said, oh, I'm going to be a martial arts instructor when I get older. So he was like, oh, okay, you're going to start doing some Tai Chi. And I was like, it's slow. I don't want to meditate. I just want to punch and kick. And he kind of would shake his head and laugh. I'm like, if this is what you really want to do, I'm not suggesting you check it out. I'm telling you what you need to train. And at the time I was sort of the, whatever you say, whatever my teacher said, I would follow along with. And I'm glad at this point in time that, you know, now I wish I'd gotten an even earlier start because of some of the depth that I've seen Tai Chi for myself pull into my training, regardless of what I want to do. But in that learning, beyond just the solo forms and the moving into some of the push hands, you know, I feel like a lot of what we're doing with these traditional arts is kind of like where, you know, we're trying to recreate and understand these methods that have been passed down from generation to generation to generation, and also through culture. So a lot of these, you know, as Dr. Yang Jingming also says in a lot of his books, you know, he has to, when he translates things, he has to kind of keep in mind the time that certain things were written and sort of the implication of one maybe Chinese character to another in terms of what you're discussing at the time. And so even for him, somebody that comes from a martial background and who is a Taiwanese native that's trying to translate some of these things, it can be difficult. And then our interpretation of these sort of ancient documents and its application is, again, we're a little bit of a shot in the dark as we're trying to recreate things. And it seems to me like if you don't have a sounding board, so something to someone or something to kind of bounce some of these feelings off of, which is largely, I think, what Tai Chi is sort of playing in is feeling. And that's just the same as a lot of combat sport or striking. It's the feeling. You're trying to get this understanding of how to use the body with somebody else and what your energy being put out kind of gives you in return, and vice versa. So for me, I think the partner work, I agree, is essential to understanding whether you're interested in the martial side of it or not. It makes you better understand sort of the goals of the practice, and all the benefit that it gets, that you can pull from it, whether it's the solo work or the health exercise or the martial sort of application or understanding. It's all kind of intertwined regardless of what you're looking for.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, and you can take that, one of the ideas you had in what you said, and expand it out even more when you think of catching the feeling. One of the things that is starting to become documented in the West is, it's very clearly documented in the West, in Western medical and Western sports medicine, and the name of what you call it slips my mind at the moment, like kinesthesiology, where you study the method of how the body works, you know, moves, is just this awareness of what your body is doing while it's doing it. And Tai Chi Chuan has been discovered or been proven to be empirically a good way to develop that, which is one of the reasons why it's suggested for practice for elderly individuals, because it really gives them a much stronger sense of their own body so they can learn. They get their balance increases and they're far less prone to falls, which is, you know, a major obstacle as one ages in life. You know, one good fall can really destroy an elderly person's life.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so that body awareness, which is integral to Tai Chi Chuan, it's the feeling of how all this stuff works. And you really, for me anyway, I really only started to develop that when I started doing pushing hands. I still practice the form and I've come to appreciate it, but I was excited to do pushing hands,
right?
That's
kind of draw for you or what, yeah, caught you initially.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like I didn't really love solo practice until a few years into my training when I learned the sword form, which I absolutely fell in love with. And I just, you know, just enjoyed so much more than the bare hand form practice. And just, it's because I watched, Errol Flynn movies and I read the Three Musketeers when I was growing up and whatnot, that, you know, running around with a sword in your hand was so much more exciting than the bare hand form.
Oh yeah.
But when I started doing, any kind of weapons practice is considered a more advanced thing than a bare hand practice sequence, as you know, simply because you have another object to incorporate in what you're doing.
Right. And a little more to manage.
Yeah. And it kind of starts to give you the feedback that you get from working with a partner. But once again,
yep.
You know, it's not the same thing as dealing with another individual's energy. It's, you know, learning how to connect to the weapon as opposed to, you know, dealing with the give and take that one gets from any kind of a two-person exercise. You know? But that was, you know, that was when I discovered I could really get into doing solo work. But it was, but it always came back to pushing hands. For the most part, anything with a partner was always more enjoyable to me and more rewarding in how it helped me to learn and grow.
Yeah, I think that exchange is always something that's exciting in any martial arts training. You feel like you sort of take what you've been working on any solo skill sets, even basic things like your conditioning, you know, your strength and conditioning, your flexibility, I think tie into any martial arts training. But when you start doing something with a partner, you now feel like that work, that effort is being applied. Like there's reason for it almost. And I think it gets a lot of people excited.
Absolutely.
Yeah, weapons training as well. I think from traditional martial arts, there's a lot that weapons training can offer. And I can remember pretty vividly, it's the thing that got me interested in doing traditional Chinese martial arts and what got me to stick around for so long. The first time I ever walked into a Kung Fu school, I saw the weapons on the wall, the swords and the Guan Dao and the spears. I just remember looking at them and being like, oh, I want to learn how to use those. And I was like, what does it take to be able to, you know, play with that? How do I get to that? And he said, oh, it takes a long time. You know, it takes a lot of practice, but if you really kind of dedicate it, you end up getting there. So that sort of is what originally got me interested. Like, all right, I'll be willing to put in the work. And then as I started working more with a partner, I got more and more involved in it. I really started to like sort of the community that a martial arts school and martial arts training has to offer beyond just, you know, doing something for yourself, but kind of doing something with someone or for a goal, whether it's working up to getting to practice with a sword or a spear, or if it's, you know, pushing hands with someone or learning a chin-a or a locking technique, being able to actually apply it.
Absolutely. And the other thing was, I remember when I first walked into YMAA, and, you know, you walked into the, well, it's what I refer to as the old building now. It's been so long, but the, that was headquartered in Jamaica Plain. you walked into the main entrance, and the first thing you saw was, as you say, the rack of weapons against the wall.
Yeah.
And some of them, I didn't even recognize, like, what kind of a weapon it was, you know, because a spear looks like a spear and a sword looks like a sword and whatnot. But some of them are like, how does one even use one of those things? You know, kind of thing. Because there were no, you know, obviously we don't see a lot of, you know, melee combat anymore in our
ancient weapons aren't as prominent in our society now.
You know, and they don't show up in cinema, you know, nearly as much as they, you know, just for color they could. Some of them are really interesting looking.
Old kung fu flick or something that'll pull something out, but almost for the same reason. It's almost that interest or intrigue of, oh, what is this thing that this guy's pulling out that I don't normally see, is almost sort of the allure of some martial arts movies.
Yeah, that reminded me. You're a martial artist, so you know what I'm talking about right now. The old TV show Kung Fu with David Carradine.
Oh, yeah.
The first incarnation, not the second incarnation. You know, and that was you can find flaws with that show, but it did put Chinese martial arts into the popular consciousness, certainly. And it was a lot of fun in some respects, but there was one episode that was mostly flashback, which was always my favorite part, when he was flashing back to the Shaolin temple in China.
Oh yeah.
Where for some reason or another, he was caught up in a duel with like a warlord in this guy's castle. And they fought with five or six, I think, probably not that many, probably memory colors it, but they fought with several different distinct weapons. Because it was not only a grudge match between this warlord and like the Shaolin temple, it was supposed to be sort of a more formalized duel. So they would fight and then change weapons and fight with something else. And I remember it was the first time I ever saw a three-section staff. That was one of the weapons that got used. And I was like, how are they going to use? That's insane. And then they started using it in the show. And I was like, oh, wow, that's incredible. That sort of thing. And they went through, you know, spears and different things like that. But the three-section staff was the thing that sticks in my memory.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
36 Chambers of Shaolin, that was sort of a big point of that movie, too, if you've ever seen that. He figures out that he could use, you know, he tries to cut the bamboo, and it folds over and hits him. And he tries to do it again, it folds over again and hits him. I think that weapon in particular, the three-section staff, is sort of a iconic draw of Chinese martial arts in cinema.
Oh, absolutely. That's such a fun movie too. That is the American, well, I think the outside of Asia, or let's say outside of China, the international community owes a really serious debt to those old kung fu movies, because that's what really caught people's attention. You know, I remember YMAA International has summer camps. And on one of them, we went to, we were in Poland. And one of the things that we did in the evening after we were done training and after dinner was they would break out copies of these old Chinese kung fu movies and we would watch it. And part of the fun was watching it in the big group. But the other part of the fun was watching a poorly dubbed in English Chinese kung fu movie that they had then retranslated into Polish on top of that. You know, and it was, and just the whole, and the guys in the group, you know, and there were probably, you know, 30 or 40 of us watching this at this point, they had memorized all the dialogue in this movie, never mind, and half of them memorized the kung fu sequences in it, that sort of thing. So I think I think a great many martial artists around the world would say that next to Bruce Lee, those movies got them into the martial arts, you know, and the Chinese martial arts in particular.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. But that was so much fun.
So kind of to trail onto that, this last piece that you were talking about, I think one of the cool things about our organization with YMAA, Yang's Martial Arts Association, is that this is an international organization and that there's a lot... there's a very large community that we kind of draw from and that we are associated with. So you mentioned that YMAA does camps and, yes. You know, it's a place where all these different sort of training schools and from different countries and cultures are coming together. Tell us a little bit about sort of your experience within this organization of YMAA, and sort of how that's impacted your life a bit with tying into that community.
Well, to do that, well, I grew up in a city that is, you know, literally, if anybody was listening to this, you know, the YMAA was headquartered in Boston. I grew up in Somerville, which is a town that's immediately on the Boston border. So it's very urban. Largely when I was growing up, it's an immigrant city. It was essentially you were families that came in and mixed together, and it was a fun place to grow up, but it was relatively speaking, a small, densely populated city. You know, so Somerville was a very urban city, and come on already.
And when
I
rains,
never get this many phone calls.
Well, they hear you're on the Sandoff Fighting Arts podcast.
Yeah,
they want to get in touch.
I know the notoriety is growing already. I love it. No, so anyway, so I had never really been outside of, you know, an American kind of urban setting, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Largely homogenous, basically white population. And then I went to the school, and first of all, the school was way over on the other side of Boston from me. So that was a big adventure. I would take the subway over there until I was able to buy a car and drive over. But, you know, it was a much more diverse community even in the Boston school, with lots of people from lots of different backgrounds there. And that was great. But one of my favorite things, or the more interesting things, was that every year the school, even before the international camps, every year Dr. Young would offer seminars. Basically, there were winter and summer seminars. So you would get people from all over the world coming to the school, and they would camp out in the school building, or they would, you know, get hotel rooms and whatnot. Yeah. And they would be there for 2 months in the summer and 2 months in the winter. And you would see a lot of the same people year after year. So you get people from Poland and from Italy and from South Africa and Hungary, really all over the place. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to make friends and meet people. And so that was like sort of the first real expansion of my horizons, so to speak. Encountering people who weren't American, you know, who had different ideas on how things work and certainly had vastly different life experiences.
Yeah, different countries, different cultures, but
yeah,
kind of coming into one place.
Yeah, sure. You know, when you think about, and this is in, say, 95 and whatnot. Let's see, I started in 87. Yeah, so I mean, it was going on, but I really started to appreciate it 5 or 6 years into the training. You know, when you think what South Africa, say, was like in 1995, where they still, you know, apartheid was on its last legs, and when you, or what Poland and Hungary, those schools who sent many practitioners over, you know, they were barely out of communism and whatnot, still recovering from that. And just really, really different worldviews from anybody who grew up in the United States. And then, you know, people from the more, the more Western side of Europe, when you had people from Italy and France and England coming in, who had just, you know, a whole different political view of how things would work. So it was always really neat in that regard to spend time and to share experiences with these guys. But the real fun thing about those summer seminars in Boston, and then what they grew into, which was the international summer camps, was that you would really be with a large group of people that you did not have to explain not only what you were doing, i.e. the martial arts, whichever one you wanted to do, and what it was you were doing. So, you know, you didn't, for a long time, people would ask me, oh, what do you do for fun? And I would say Tai Chi Chuan. And, you know, you would get a blank look. And if they're interested enough, that you could kind of try to pursue a discussion on it. But most of the time, people are just being nice and they want to have a conversation. You know, they want to be socially polite. They ask you, what do you do for fun? And they don't want a 20-minute discussion on why you do this slow motion martial art, you know? And but at the summer seminars here in Boston, and then the summer camps started out in Poland and then grew from out of there. It was wonderful, you know, just to be with a group of people, particularly the international camps, because they were all the good things about the summer seminars intensified, because you had 10 days of basically from dawn until whenever you were too tired to keep practicing or keep doing something kind of training.
Right.
You know, of the thing you love to do, surrounded by a group of people who are all into it, whose common language was this martial art, and led by Dr. Yang Jingming, who is a wonderful teacher. And if anybody who listens, if they ever really want to get the best experience of working with Dr. Yang, in my opinion, it's you get him in a seminar when there's a lot of people who are excited to be doing it. And that's where he really comes alive. And I think that's true of anybody when you've got this really positive, powerful energy coming out of the group you're working with. I know as a teacher, sometimes you have to work the group to get their enthusiasm, you know. If the enthusiasm is already there, then a teacher can do a lot. You can have a lot of fun. But, you know, these 10-day summer seminars with people from 15, 20 countries coming in, and, you know, we'd be in Krakow or Gdansk in Poland that's a different thing in Egypt. That wasn't something else. I get lots of martial arts related travel, and sometimes the places blur, you know, but places in cities in Hungary, you know, and probably the most remarkable for me personally was when YMA South Africa under Corlius Berkel, he was the gentleman hosting it. Yep. When we had the summer camp down in South Africa, and that was just staggering in the best sense of the word, you know, because it's this long flight. It's like 8 hours to Europe and then 12 hours to Johannesburg. And then it was another 5 hours by bus to get to the resort. So, you know, this
big trip.
This big trip. And the fun thing, or the thing about a long period of travel like that, is it breaks you out of your normal way of looking at things. At least that's what it does for me, because you're so disconnected and exhausted. You're disconnected from your normal routines and you're exhausted from like 24 hours continuous travel
that takes a lot out of you.
It does. And it shakes your mind loose from some of the ruts you're in. And then to jump into, once again, this wonderful training environment, which was always the constant, but the geographic location, you know, would change from year to year. And it just made it this marvelous experience of the world. And I come back to what I said at the beginning, that learning Tai Chi Chuan was the best decision I ever made, because of it, many people can say this kind of thing because we're fortunate that travel is a bit easier now, but because of Tai Chi Chuan, I've walked on four different continents, you know, and for me personally, that's a big thing to say.
Yeah, definitely. For sure.
And, you know, I've seen the Northern Lights on a rafting trip I was going with YMAA, you know, we went that far north in Maine. And because of a friend of mine named Rommel Rones, another very, very skilled practitioner of the martial arts, I got invited to his wedding in Israel, so I've seen the Milky Way going across the Red Sea towards Aqaba, you know, because of the martial arts, you know, and because of YMAA International, to go back to where your question is, you know, those, you know, to be part of an organization that, you know, if you want to, if you know you're going to be traveling, you can say, I'm going to be in Europe. Let me see if there's a YMAA school so I can get a workout in. And if you're a member, you're a member. You just contact them and you say, hey, can I drop in for classes? I'm going to be in town for this weekend. And once again, the martial arts are the common language.
Yeah.
So you've got something that will help you feel at home while you're far away, and something that will introduce you to a new facet of the world, which is really cool, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. I think that it's really a testament to what martial arts can be and can do. And like you said just now and in the beginning of the podcast, the impact sort of that it can have on your life, you know, not just the training or not just the art or maybe why you're initially interested in learning anything, Tai Chi, Kung Fu, kickboxing, karate, you know, any kind of martial art, but the fact that it can lead to something like, you know, traveling all over the world and, you know, finding your life partner and, you know, longtime friends and, sort of all the things that it does for yourself in terms of how it shapes you and who you feel sort of internally, who you are, and kind of knowing what you can do, is amazing. I think that's such a great example of just how much depth martial arts can give to someone beyond the fighting aspect or the health aspect of what martial arts is.
Go ahead, please.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. So, I thought just kind of on an ending note, if you were to give a piece of information or a piece of advice to someone that was interested in Tai Chi or looking maybe to start training martial arts and Tai Chi, what information or advice would you give to somebody that's curious about what that kind of training would involve or what they'd be in for, so to speak, in getting involved?
Yeah, well, you know, people do ask me that, you know, you get that question. It's like, I get it in the format, what should I look for in a school?
Yeah.
You know? And I say, well, the first thing you have to ask yourself is like, what do you really want in what you're doing? Do you want, do you want to learn how to fight? Because I won't even bother with the term self-defense, because I think self-defense is a marketing thing on one level. Sure. If you're performing self-defense, then you're fighting, but you're fighting to protect yourself or somebody else. So it's, you know, it's, do you want to learn how to fight? Are you just looking for, you know, some kind of a workout that's different than lifting weights in the gym that has a different structure? Or are you looking for the health aspects like you get from the practice of Tai Chi Chuan and its related discipline of Qi Kung? And I said, so that's the first thing a person has to ask, is what do they really want? And it may take a little while to figure that out.
Yeah.
And once they can answer that question for themselves, I would say that you have to go to a couple of different, don't do what I did, which was go to one school and fall in love with it and stay there for 30 years. go to different schools or go to a school and check out their classes. Maybe not even necessarily participating in a class, but just go in, say to the person at the front desk or the head of the school, whatever it is, you know, I'm interested in a martial art. Can I watch your class and find out, you know, what they do in the course of however long one of their classes is, you know, like is a 90-minute session or whatnot, you know, so you can walk in with your eyes open.
Yep.
And know that, okay, these guys do, these guys like to go back to the Shaolin stuff when I was much younger, in my opinion, the class got a little misdirected, but we did 45 minutes of panther walks in one class one time, you know, which is, you know what those are, right?
Yes. I make my students do them quite often, but for those who don't know, it's being down into basically a push-up position and popping quickly off of your arms to get slightly airborne and pushing yourself forward or backwards or side to side. It's a grueling drill, but builds very strong conditioning.
Absolutely. It's wonderful conditioning and training. I wouldn't suggest trying to do it for 45 minutes, and then do another hour and 15 minutes of Kung Fu, so that's the kind of thing you got to know that when you walk into a school, right? And once you get a look at a class, you know, the other thing I would suggest doing, which is a lot easier now than it was, even a decade ago, was, you know, Google the school and Google the style and just dig into what underlies it. So you can find out, is this something that I want to attempt, you know?
Right.
But ultimately, anybody's relationship with the martial arts, and I think you mentioned it at one point in time, it all comes back to your relationship with the teacher and with the school, the core group at the school. And if you have a good teacher who, you know, can convey the information on the style effectively, and you have a good core group of people to work out with. And by good, I don't mean just technically adept. I mean people who are good people, you know.
Yeah, and compatible with you.
And compatible with you, you know. Then martial arts is just a wonderful, wonderful experience, you know. But it's definitely, you're going to sweat. You may bleed, frankly,
Sure. Fighting arts are still fighting arts.
there still are times when I come back from a class and, you know, by the time I get out of my car after my ride home, I have to pull myself into an upright position because I've stiffened up so much from the exertions. And that was true the first week after class, and it was true this last Saturday when I got home from class. I mean, you if you're lucky, you get a really good workout, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, that you use your body and you try to push yourself past your limits, and you do more than just break a sweat. You push yourself a little bit and you reach a new level, and it takes time, but you can do it. But that's the essence of a martial art, in my opinion, if you want to pursue it, is there is discomfort in it. You know, there is the possibility of injury.
Sure.
That's the other thing that anybody who wants to practice a martial art has to realize, is that there is the possibility that you're going to get hurt. There is also the possibility that accidentally you could hurt somebody else. So it's all practicing a martial art is different than in some of the other physical disciplines where, you know, if you do gymnastics, obviously the possibility for injury is there. You're probably not going to hurt somebody else, you know? So it's that sort of mental evaluation you have to go through. But I would say if you want to practice a martial art, research the school, sit in on a class, and understand, most importantly, what you want to get out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's spot on. And that's especially today with being able to, like, kind of like you said, Google, like you're able to get a lot of information.
Sure.
On different styles and the school and get a feeling for the school, but certainly going and meeting the heads of the school and the instructors and the students and sort of seeing how a class operates and making sure it's a good fit is probably also, in my opinion, more important than the style or, you know, this school's right next to me, so it's the best, my best option, because I can get to it in 5 minutes opposed to the one that's, you know, like you had, that was all the way on the other side of town, you know, is very important. All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day and chatting with us a little bit. I appreciate you coming on and being our guest.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, guys, that's it. Thank you for joining us with the Sandoff Fighting Arts Podcast. Be sure to hit subscribe on any platform that you find us on. We can be found on everywhere that podcasts are found, on Google Play and Apple Podcasts and the Anchor app, who we are recording and putting our podcast out through. If you're interested in submitting any questions or being a guest or anything on our podcast, you're able to do so directly through the Anchor app. So check that out and find us, Sandoff Fighting Arts, and you can submit questions right through the app. It's a really cool way to connect. But we appreciate everybody sticking around, and we will see you next time.